Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Laurie Moore. By the River by Joyce Carol Oates. Helen thought, am I in love again? Some new kind of love? Is that why I'm here? She was sitting in the waiting room of the yellow bus line station. She knew the big old room with its dirty tile floor and its solitary telephone booth in the corner, and its candy machine and cigarette machine and popcorn machine by heart. Everything was familiar, though she had been gone for 4 months. Even the old woman with the dyed red hair who sold tickets and had been selling them there behind that counter for as long as Helen could remember. Years ago, before Helen's marriage, she and her girlfriends would be driven into town by someone's father, and after they tired of walking around town, they would stroll over to the bus station to watch the buses unload. They were anxious to see who was getting off, but few of the passengers who got off stayed in Oriskany. They were just passing through, stopping for a rest and a drink, and their faces seemed to say that they didn't think much of the town. Nor did they seem to think much of the girls from the country who stood around in their colorful dresses and smiled shyly at strangers, not knowing any better. They were taught to be kind to people, to smile first. You never knew who it might be. So now Helen was back in Oriskany, but this time she had come in on a bus herself, had ridden alone all the way from the city of Derby, all alone, and was waiting for her father to pick her up so she could go back to her old life without any more fuss. It was hot. Flies crawled languidly around. A woman with a small, sickly-faced baby had to keep waving them away. The old woman selling tickets looked at Helen as if her eyes were drawn irresistibly that way, as if she knew every nasty rumor and wanted to let Helen know that she knew. Helen's forehead broke out in perspiration, and she stood abruptly, wanting to dislodge that old woman's stare. She went over to the candy machine, but did not look at the candy bars. She looked at herself in the mirror. Her own reflection always made her feel better. Whatever went on inside her head, and right now she felt nervous about something, had nothing to do with the way she looked, her smooth, gentle skin and the faint freckles on her forehead and nose, and the cool, innocent green of her eyes. She was just a girl from the country, and anyone in town would know that, even if they didn't know her personally. One of those easy, friendly girls who hummed to themselves and seemed always to be glancing up as if expecting something pleasant. Her light brown hair curled back lazily toward her ears, cut short now because it was the style. In high school she had worn it long. She watched her eyes in the mirror. No alarm there, really. She would be back home in an hour or so. Not her husband's home, of course, but her parents' home. And her face in the mirror was the face she had always seen. 22 she was now, and to her that seemed old. But she looked no different from the way she had looked on her wedding day 5 years ago. But it was stupid to try to link together those two Helens, she thought. She went back to the row of seats and sat heavily. If the old woman was still watching, she did not care. A sailor in a soiled white uniform sat nearby, smoking, watching her but not with too much interest. He had other girls to recall. Helen opened her purse and looked inside at nothing and closed it again. The man she had been living with in the city for 4 months had told her it was stupid. No, he had not used that word. He said something fancy like immature, to confuse herself with the child she had been, married woman as she was now, and a mother, adulterous married woman. And the word adulterous made her lips turn up in a slow, bemused smile, the first flash of incredulous pride one might feel when told at last the disease that is going to be fatal. For there were so many diseases and only one way out of the world, only one death and so many ways to get to it. They were like doors, Helen thought dreamily. You walk down a hallway like those in the movies, in huge, wealthy homes, crystal chandeliers and marble floors and great sweeping lawns, and doors all along those hallways. If you picked the wrong door, you had to go through it. She was dreamy, drowsy. When thought became too much for her, when he had pestered her so much about marrying him, divorcing her husband and marrying him, always him, she had felt so sleepy she could not listen. If she was not interested in a word, her mind wouldn't hear it, but made it blurred and strange, like words half heard in dreams or through some thick substance like water. You didn't have to hear a word if you didn't want to. So she telephoned her father the night before and told him the 3:15 bus, and now it was 3:30. Where was he? Over the telephone, he had sounded slow and solemn. It could have been a stranger's voice. Helen had never liked telephones because you could not see smiles or gestures, and talking like that made her tired. Listening to her father, she had felt for the first time, since she had run away and left them all behind, husband, baby girl, family, in-laws, the minister, the dreary sun-bleached look of the land, that she had perhaps died and only imagined she was running away. Nobody here trusted the city. It was too big. Helen had wanted to go there all her life, not being afraid of anything, or so she had gone, and was coming back. But it was an odd feeling, this dreamy ghostliness, as if she were really dead and coming back in a form that only looked like herself. She was bored, thinking of this, and crossed her bare legs. The sailor crushed out a cigarette in the dirty tin ashtray, and their eyes met. Helen felt a little smile tug at her lips. That was the trouble. She knew men too well. She knew their eyes and their gestures, like the sailor rubbing thoughtfully at his chin now, as if he hadn't shaved well enough but really liked to feel his own skin. She knew them too well and had never figured out why. Her sister, 4 years older, wasn't like that. But to Helen, the same man, 100 times or 100 men, different men, seemed the same. It was wrong, of course, because she had been taught it and believed what she had always been taught. But she could not understand the difference. The sailor watched her, but she looked away, half closing her eyes. She had no time for him. Her father should be here now. He would be here in a few minutes, so there was no time. She would be home in an hour. When she thought of her father, the ugly bus station with its odor of tobacco and spilled soft drinks seemed to fade away. She remembered his voice the night before. How gentle and soft she had felt listening to that voice, giving in to the protection he represented. She had endured his rough hands as a child because she knew they protected her, and all her life they had protected her. There had always been trouble, sometimes the kind you laughed about later and sometimes not. That was one of the reasons she had married Paul, and before Paul there had been others, just boys who didn't count, who had no jobs and thought mainly about their cars. She had called her father from a roadhouse 60 miles away once when she was 15. She and her best friend Annie had gotten mixed up with some men they had met at a picnic. That had been frightening, Helen thought, but now she could have handled them. She gave everyone too much. That was her trouble. Her father had said that. Even her mother. Lent money to girls at the telephone company where she'd worked. Lent her girlfriend's clothes. Would run outside when some man drove up and blew his horn, not bothering to get out and knock at the door the way he should. She liked to make other people happy. What was wrong with that? Was she too lazy to care? Her head had begun to ache. Always her thoughts ran one way, fast and innocent, but her body did other things. It got warm, nervous. It could not relax. Was she afraid of what her father's face would tell her? She pushed that idea away. It was nonsense. If she had to think of something, let it be of that muddy spring day when her family had first moved to this part of the country, into an old farmhouse her father had bought at a bargain. At that time the road out in front of the house had been no more than a single dirt lane. Now it was wider, covered with blacktop that smelled ugly and made your eyesight shimmer and sweat with confusion in the summer. Yes, that big old house. Nothing about it would have changed. She did not think of her own house, her husband's house, because it mixed her up too much right now. Maybe she would go back and maybe not. She did not think of him. If she wanted to go back, she would. He would take her in. When she tried to think of what had brought her back, it was never her husband. So much younger, quicker, happier than the man she had just left. And not the little girl, either, but something to do with her family's house and that misty, warm day 17 years ago when they first moved in. So one morning when that man left for work, her thoughts had turned back to home, and she had sat at the breakfast table for an hour or so, not clearing off the dishes, looking at the coffee left in his cup as if it were a forlorn reminder of him, a man she was even beginning to forget. She knew then that she did not belong there in the city. It wasn't that she stopped loving this man. She never stopped loving anyone who needed her, and he had needed her more than anyone. It was something else, something she did not understand. Not her husband, not her baby, not even the look of the river way off down the hill, through the trees that got so solemn and intricate with their bare branches in winter. Those things she loved, she hadn't stopped loving them because she had to love this new man more. but something else made her get up and run into the next room and look through the bureau drawers and the closet as if looking for something. That evening, when he returned, she explained to him that she was going back. He was over 40, she wasn't sure how much, and it had always been his hesitant, apologetic manner that had made her love him, the odor of failure about him that mixed with the odor of the drinking he could not stop, even though he had cut down now with her help. Why were so many afraid? Why did they think so much? He did something that had to do with keeping books. Was that nervous work? He was an attractive man, but that wasn't what Helen had seen in him. It was his staring at her when they first met, and the way he had run his hand through his thinning hair, telling her in that gesture that he wanted her and wanted to be young enough to tell her so. That had been 4 months ago. The months all rushed to Helen's mind, and the memory she had of his keen, intelligent, baffled eyes, and the tears she had had to see in them when she went out to call her father. Now, back on Oriskany, she would think of him no more. A few minutes later, her father came. Was that really him, she thought? Her heart beat furiously. If blood drained out of her face, she would look mottled and sick, as if she had a rash. How she hated that! Though he had seen her at once, though the bus station was nearly empty, her father hesitated until she stood and ran to him. "Pa," she said, "I'm so glad to see you." It might have been years ago, and he was just going to drive back home now, finished with his business in town, and Helen, 14 or 15, waiting to go back with him. "I'll get your suitcase," he said. The sailor was reading a magazine, no longer interested. Helen watched her father nervously. What was wrong? He stooped, taking hold of the suitcase handle, but he did not straighten fast enough. Just a heartbeat too slow. Why was that? Helen took a tissue already stained with lipstick and dabbed it on her forehead. On the way home, he drove oddly, as if the steering wheel, heated by the sun, were too painful for him to hold. "No more trouble with the car, huh?" Helen said. "It's all right," he said. They were nearly out of town already. Helen saw few people she knew. "Why are you looking around?" her father said. His voice was pleasant, and his eyes fastened seriously upon the road as if he did not dare look elsewhere. "Oh, just looking," Helen said. "How is Davy?" Waiting for her father to answer, he always took his time, Helen arranged her skirt nervously beneath her. Davy was her sister's baby. Could he be sick? She had forgotten to ask about him the night before. "Nothing's wrong with Davy, is there, Pa?" she said. "No, nothing." "I thought Ma might come, maybe," Helen said. "No. Didn't she want to? Mad at me, huh?" In the past, her mother's dissatisfaction with her had always ranged Helen and her father together. Helen could tell by a glance of her father's when this was so. But he did not look away from the road. They were passing the new high school, the consolidated high school Helen had attended for a year. No one had known what consolidated meant or was interested in knowing. Helen frowned at the dark brick, and there came to her mind, out of nowhere, the word adulteress, for it, too, had been a word she had not understood for years. A word out of the Bible. It was like a mosquito bothering her at night, or a stain on her dress, the kind she would have to hide without seeming to, letting her hand fall accidentally over it. For some reason, the peculiar smell of the old car, the rattling sunshades above the windshield, the same old khaki blanket they used for a seat cover, did not comfort her and let her mind get drowsy to push that word away. She was not sleepy, but she said she was. "Yes, honey, why don't you lay back and try to sleep then," her father said. He glanced toward her. She felt relieved at once, made simple and safe. She slid over and leaned her head against her father's shoulder. "Bus ride was long. I hate bus rides," she said. "I used to like them." "You can sleep till we get home." "Is Ma mad?" "No." His shoulder wasn't as comfortable as it should have been, but she closed her eyes, trying to force sleep. She remembered that April day they had come here, their moving to the house that was new to them, a house of their own they would have to share with no one else, but a house, it turned out, had things wrong with it, secret things that had made Helen's father furious. She could not remember the city and the house they had lived in there, but she had been old enough to sense the simplicity of the country and the eagerness of her parents, and then the angry perplexity that had followed. The family was big, 6 children then, before Arthur died at 10, and half an hour after they had moved in, the house was crowded and shabby. and she remembered being frightened at something and her father picking her up right in the middle of moving and not asking her why she cried. Her mother had always asked her that, as if there were a reason, but rocked her and comforted her with his rough hands. And she could remember how the house had looked so well, the ballooning curtains in the windows, the first thing her mother had put up. The gusty spring air, already too warm, smelling of good earth, and the Eden River not too far behind them, and leaves, sunlight, wind, and the sagging porch piled with cartons and bundles and pieces of furniture from the old house. In that old dark house in the city, the grandparents had died, her mother's parents, and Helen did not remember them at all except as her father summoned them back, recalling with hatred his wife's father, some little confused argument they had had years ago, and that he should have won. That old man had died, and the house had gone to the bank somewhere mysterious, and her father had brought them all out here to the country. A new world, a new life, a farm, and four boys to help, and the promise of such good soil. Her father turned the wheel sharply. "Rabbit run across," he said. He had this strange air of apology for whatever he did, even if it was something gentle. He hated to kill animals, even weasels and hawks. Helen wanted to cover his right hand with hers, that thickened, dirt-creased hand that could never be made clean. But she said, stirring a little, as if he had woken her, "Then why didn't Ma want to come?" They were taking a long, slow curve. Helen knew without looking up which curve this was, between two wheat fields that belonged to one of the old, old families, those prosperous men who drove broken-down pickup trucks and dressed no better than their own hired hands, but who had money, much money, not just in one bank, but in many. "Yes, they're money people," Helen remembered her father saying years ago, passing someone's pasture. Those ugly red cows meant nothing to Helen, but they meant something to her father. And so after her father had said that, they'd been out for a drive after church, her mother got sharp and impatient, and the ride was ruined. That was years ago. Helen's father had been a young man then, with a raw, waiting, untested look, with muscular arms and shoulders that needed only to be directed to their work. "They're money people," he had said, and that had ruined the ride, as if by magic. It had been as if the air itself had changed, the direction of the wind changing and easing to them from the river that was often stagnant in August and September, and not from the green land. With an effort, Helen remembered that she had been thinking about her mother. Why did her mind push her into the past so often these days? She only 22. That was not old, not really, and going to begin a new life. Once she got home and took a bath and washed out the things in the suitcase and got some rest and took a walk down by the river as she had as a child, skipping stones across it, and sat around the round kitchen table with the old oilcloth cover to listen to their advice. "You got to grow up now. You ain't 15 anymore," that had been her mother last time. Then she would decide what to do, make her decision about her husband and the baby, and there would be nothing left to think about. "Why didn't Ma come?" "I didn't want her to," he said. Helen swallowed without meaning to. His shoulder was thin and hard against the side of her face. Were those same muscles still there, or had they become worn away like the soil that was sucked down into the river every year, stolen from them, so that the farm Helen's father had bought turned out to be a kind of joke on him? Or were they a different kind of muscle, hard and compressed like steel, drawn into themselves from years of resisting violence? "How come?" Helen said. He did not answer. She shut her eyes tight, and distracting, eerie images came to her, stars exploding and shadowy figures like those in movies. She had gone to the movies all the time in the city, often taking in the first show at 11 in the morning, not because she was lonely or had nothing to do, but because she liked movies. 5:20, and he would come up the stairs, grimacing a little with the strange, inexplicable pain in his chest. And there Helen would be, back from downtown, dressed up and her hair shining, and her face ripe and fresh as a child's, not because she was proud of the look in his eyes, but because she knew she could not make that pain of his abate for a while. And so why had she left him, when he had needed her more than anyone? "Pa, is something wrong?" she said, as if the recollection of that other man's invisible pain were in some way connected with her father. He reached down vaguely and touched her hand. She was surprised at this. The movie images vanished, those beautiful people she had wanted to believe in, as she had wanted to believe in God and the saints in their movie world heaven, and she opened her eyes. The sun was bright. It had been too bright all summer. Helen's mind felt sharp and nervous, as if pricked by tiny needles. But when she tried to think of what they could be, no explanation came to her. She would be home soon. She would be able to rest. Tomorrow she could get in touch with Paul. Things could begin where they had left off. Paul had always loved her so much, and he had always understood her, had known what she was like. "Ma's in sick, is she?" Helen said suddenly. "No," said her father. He released her fingers to take hold of the steering wheel again. Another curve. Off to the side, if she bothered to look, the river had swung toward them, low at this time of year, covered in places with a fine brown-green layer of scum. She did not bother to look. "We moved out here 17 years ago," her father said. He cleared his throat, the gesture of a man unaccustomed to speech. "You don't remember that." "Yes, I do," Helen said. "I remember that." "You don't. You were just a baby." "Pa, I remember it. I remember you carrying the big rug in the house, you and Eddie, and I started to cry and you picked me up. I was such a big baby, always crying, and Ma came out and chased me inside so I wouldn't bother you." "You don't remember that," her father said. He was driving jerkily, pressing down on the gas pedal and then letting it up, as if new thoughts continually struck him. What was wrong with him? Helen had an idea she didn't like. He was older now. He was going to become an old man. If she had been afraid of the dark, upstairs in that big old farmhouse in the room she shared with her sister, all she had had to do was to think of him. He had a way of sitting at the supper table that was so still, so silent, that you knew nothing could budge him. Nothing could frighten him. So as a child, and even now that she was grown up, it helped her to think of her father's face, those pale, surprised green eyes that could be simple or cunning, depending on the light, and the lines working themselves in deeper every year around his mouth, and the hard angle of his jaw going back to the ear, burned by the sun and then tanned by it, turned into leather, then going pale again in the winter. The sun could not burn its color deep enough into that skin, which was almost as fair as Helen's. At Sunday school, she and the other children had been told to think of Christ when they were afraid, but the Christ she saw on the little blue bookmark cards and calendars was no one to protect you. That was a man who would be your cousin, maybe, some cousin you liked but saw rarely, but he looked so given over to thinking and trusting that he could not be of much help, not like her father. When he and the boys came in from the fields with the sweat drenching their clothes and their faces, looking as if they were dissolving with heat, you could still see the solid flesh beneath, the skeleton that hung onto its muscles and would never get old, never die. The boys, her brothers, all older, had liked her well enough, Helen being the baby, and her sister had watched her most of the time, and her mother had liked her too. Or did her mother like anyone, having been brought up by German-speaking parents who had had no time to teach her love? But it had always been her father she had run to. She had started knowing men by knowing him. She could read things in his face that taught her about the faces of other men, the slowness or quickness of their thoughts, if they were beginning to be impatient, or were pleased and didn't want to show it yet. Was it for this she had come home? And the thought surprised her so that she sat up, because she did not understand. Was it for this she had come home? "Pa," she said, "like I told you on the telephone, I don't know why I did it. I don't know why I went. That's all right, isn't it? I mean, I'm sorry for it. Isn't that enough? Did you talk to Paul?" "Paul? Why Paul?" "What? You haven't asked about him until now, so why now?" "What do you mean? He's my husband, isn't he? Did you talk to him?" "He came over to the house almost every night for 2 weeks. 3 weeks," he said. Helen could not understand the queer, chatty tone of his voice. "Then off and on, all the time. No, I didn't tell him you were coming." "But why not?" Helen laughed nervously. "Don't you like him?" "You know I like him, you know that. But if I told him, he'd have gone down to get you, not me." "Not if I said it was you I wanted." "I didn't want him to know. Your mother doesn't know either." "What? You mean you didn't tell her?" Helen looked at the side of his face. It was rigid and bloodless behind the tan, as if something inside were shrinking away and leaving just his voice. "You mean you didn't even tell Ma? She doesn't know I'm coming?" "No." The nervous prickling in her brain returned suddenly. Helen rubbed her forehead. "Pa," she said gently, "why didn't you tell anybody? You're ashamed of me, huh?" He drove on slowly. They were following the bends of the river, that wide, shallow, meandering river the boys said wasn't worth fishing in any longer. One of the tributaries branched out suddenly. Mud Creek, it was called. All mud and bullfrogs and dragonflies and weeds, and they drove over it on a rickety wooden bridge that thumped beneath them. "Pa," Helen said carefully, "you said you weren't mad on the phone, and I wrote you that letter explaining. I wanted to write some more, but you know, I don't write much, never even wrote to Annie when she moved away. I never forgot about you or anything or Ma. I thought about the baby, too, and Paul, but Paul could always take care of himself. He's smart. He really is. I was in the store with him one time, and he was arguing with some salesman and got the best of them. He never learned all that from his father. The whole family is smart, though, aren't they?" "The Hendrixes? Sure. You don't get money without brains." "Yes, and they got money, too. Paul never had to worry. In a house like his parents' house, nothing gets lost or broken. You know, it isn't like it was at ours when we were all kids. That's part of it. When Paul's father built us our house, I was real pleased and real happy, but then something of them came in with it, too. Everything is supposed to be clean and put in its place, and after you have a baby, you get so tired. But his mother was always real nice to me. I don't complain about them. I like them all real well."
"Money people always act nice," her father said. "Why shouldn't they?"
"Oh, Pa," Helen said, tapping at his arm, "what do you mean by that? You always been nicer than anybody I know, that's the truth. Real nice. A lot of them with those big farms like Paul's father and that tractor store they got, they complain a lot. They do. You just don't hear about it. And when that baby got polio over in the Rapids, that real big farm, you know what I mean? The McGuires. How do you think they felt? They got troubles just like everybody else." Then her father did a strange thing. Here they were 7 or 8 miles from home, no house near, and he stopped the car. "Want to rest for a minute," he said. Yet he kept staring out the windshield as if he were still driving. "What's wrong?" "Sun on the hood of the car." Helen tugged at the collar of her dress, pulling it away from her damp neck. When had the heat ever bothered her father before? She remembered going out to the farthest field with water for him before he had given up that part of the farm, and he would take the jug from her and lift it to his lips, and it would seem to Helen, the sweet child Helen standing in the dusty corn, that the water flowed into her magnificent father and enlivened him as if it were secret blood of her own she had given him. And his chest would swell, his reddened arms eager with muscle emerging out from his rolled-up sleeves, and his eyes now wiped of sweat and exhaustion. The vision pleased and confused her, for what had it to do with the man now beside her? She stared at him and saw that his nose was queerly white and that there were many tiny red veins about it, hardly more than pen lines, and his hair was thinning and jagged, growing back stiffly from his forehead as if he had brushed it back impatiently with his hand once too often. When Eddie, the oldest boy, moved away now and lost to them, had pushed their father hard in the chest and knocked him back against the supper table, that same amazed white look had come to his face, starting at his nose. "I was thinking if we got home now, I could help Ma with supper," Helen said. She touched her father's arm as if to waken him. "It's real hot. She'd like some help. She doesn't know you're coming. But I could help anyway." She tried to smile, watching his face for a hint of something. Many times in the past he had looked stern, but could be made to break into a smile. Finally, if she teased him long enough. "But didn't Ma hear you talk on the phone? Wasn't she there?" "She was there." "Well, but then?" "I told her you just talked, never said nothing about coming home." The heat had begun to make Helen dizzy. Her father opened the door on his side. "Let's get out for a minute, go down by the river," he said. Helen slid across and got out. The ground felt uncertain beneath her feet. Her father was walking and saying something, and she had to run to catch up with him. He said, "We moved out here 17 years ago. There were 6 of us then, but you don't remember. Then the boy died. And you don't remember your mother's parents and their house, that goddamn stinking house, and how I did all the work for them in his store. You remember the store down front? The dirty sawdust floor and the old women coming in for sausage enough to make you want to puke, and pig's feet and brains out of cows or guts or what the hell they were that people ate in that neighborhood. I could puke for all my life and not get clean of it. You just got born then, and we were dirt to your mother's people, just dirt. I was dirt.
And when they died, somebody else got the house. It was all owned by somebody else. And so we said how it was for the best, and we'd come out here and start all over. You don't remember it or know nothing about us. What's wrong, Pa? Helen said. She took his arm as they descended the weedy bank. You talk so funny. Did you get something to drink before you came to the bus station? You never said these things before. I thought it wasn't just meat, but a grocery store, like the one in... And we came out here, he said, loudly interrupting her, and bought that son of a bitch of a house with the roof half rotted through and the well all shot to hell. And those bastards never looked at us, never believed we were real people. The Hendrixes, too. They were like all of them. They looked through me in town. Do you know that? Like you look through a window. They didn't see me. It was because hillbilly families were in that house, came and went, pulled out in the middle of the night, owing everybody money. They all thought we were like that. I said we were poor, but we weren't hillbillies. I said, do I talk like a hillbilly? We come from the city. But nobody gave a damn. You could go up to them and shout in their faces, and they wouldn't hear you, not even when they started losing money themselves. I prayed to God during them bad times that they'd all lose what they had, every bastard one of them, that Swede with the fancy cattle most of all. I prayed to God to bring them down to me so that they could see me, my children as good as theirs, and me a harder worker than any of them. If you work till you feel like dying, you've done the best you can do, whatever money you get. I'd have told them that. I wanted to come into their world even if I had to be on the bottom of it, just so long as they gave me a name. Pa, you've been drinking, Helen said softly. I had it all fixed, what I'd tell them, he said. They were down by the river bank now. Fishermen had cleared a little area and stuck Y-shaped branches into the dried mud to rest their poles on. Helen's father prodded one of the little sticks with his foot and then did something Helen had never seen anyone do in her life, not even boys. He brought his foot down on it and smashed it. You oughtn't have done that, Helen said. Why'd you do that? And I kept on and on. It was 17 years. I never talked about it to anyone. Your mother and me never had much to say. You know that. She was like her father. You remember that first day? It was spring, nice and warm, and the wind came along when we were moving the stuff in and was so different from the smell in the city. My God! It was a whole new world here. I remember it, Helen said. She was staring out at the shallow, muddy river. Across the way, birds were sunning themselves stupidly on flat white rocks covered with dried moss like veils. You don't remember nothing, her father said angrily. Nothing! You were the only one of them I loved because you didn't remember. It was all for you. First I did it for me, myself, to show that bastard father of hers that was dead. Then those other bastards, those big farms around us. But then for you, for you. You were the baby. I said to God that when you grew up, it'd be you in one of them big houses with everything fixed and painted all the time, and new machinery, and driving around in a nice car, not this thing we got. I said I would do that for you or die. That's real nice, Pa, Helen said nervously. But I never knew nothing about it, or I was happy enough any way I was. I liked it at home. I got along with Ma better than anybody did. And I liked Paul, too. I didn't marry him just because you told me to. I mean, you never pushed me around. I wanted to marry him all by myself because he loved me. I was always happy, Pa. If Paul didn't have the store coming to him and that land and all, I'd have married him anyway. You oughtn't to have worked all that hard for me. In spite of the heat, she felt suddenly chilled. On either side of them, tall grass shrank back from the cleared, padded area, stiff and dried with August heat. These weeds gathered upon themselves in a brittle tumult back where the vines and foliage of trees began, the weeds dead and whitened, and the vines a glossy, rich green, as if sucking life out of the water into which they drooped. All along the river bank, trees and bushes leaned out and showed a yard or two of dead, whitish brown where the water line had once been. This river bent so often you could never see far along it, only a mile or so. Then foliage began, confused and unmoving. What were they doing here, she and her father? A thought came to Helen and frightened her. She was not used to thinking that they ought not to be here, that this was some other kind of slow, patient world where time didn't care at all for her or her girl's face or her generosity of love, but would push right past her and go on to touch the faces of other people. "Pa, let's go home." "Let's go home," she said. Her father bent and put his hands into the river. He brought them dripping to his face. "That's dirty there, Pa," she said. A mad, dry buzzing started up somewhere, hornets or wasps. Helen looked around but saw nothing. "God listened and didn't say yes or no," her father said. He was squatting at the river and now looked back at her, his chin creasing. The back of his shirt was wet. If I could read him right, it was something like this, that I was caught in myself and them money people caught in themselves and God himself caught in what he was and so couldn't be anything else. Then I never thought about God again.
"I think about God," Helen said. "I do. People should think about God, then they wouldn't have wars and things."
"No, I never bothered about God again," he said slowly. "If he was up there or not, it never had nothing to do with me. A hailstorm that knocked down the wheat or a drought? What the hell? Whose fault? It wasn't God's no more than mine, so I let him out of it. I knew I was in it all on my own. Then after a while it got better year by year. We paid off the farm and the new machines. You were in school then in town, and when we went into the church, they said hello to us sometimes because we outlasted them hillbillies by 10 years. And now Mike ain't doing bad on his own place, got a nice car, and me and Bill get enough out of the farm, so it ain't too bad. I mean, it ain't too bad. But it wasn't money I wanted." He was staring at her. She saw something in his face that mixed with the buzzing of the hornets and fascinated her so that she could not move, could not even try to tease him into smiling, too. "It wasn't never money I wanted," he said.
"Pa, why don't we go home?"
"I don't know what it was exactly," he said, still squatting. His hands touched the ground idly. "I tried to think of it last night when you called, and all night long and driving into town today. I tried to think of it. I guess I'm awful tired from that bus. I don't feel good," Helen said. "Why did you leave with that man?"
"What?"
"Oh," she said, touching the tip of one of the weeds. "I met him at Paul's cousin's place, where they got that real nice tavern and a dance hall."
"Why did you run away with him?"
"I don't know. I told you in the letter. I wrote it to you, Pa. He acted so nice and liked me so. He still does. He loves me very much. And he was always so sad and tired. He made me think of you, Pa. But not really, because he's not strong like you and couldn't ever do work like you. And if he loved me that much, I had to go with him."
"Then why did you come back?"
"Come back?" Helen tried to smile out across the water. Sluggish, ugly water, this river that disappointed everyone, so familiar to her that she could not really get used to a house without a river or creek somewhere behind it, flowing along night and day. Perhaps that was what she had missed in the city. "I came back because—" And she shredded the weed in her cold fingers, but no words came to her. She watched them fall. No words came to her. Her mind had turned hollow and cold. She had come too far down to this river bank, but it was not a mistake any more than the way the river kept moving was a mistake. It just happened. Her father got slowly to his feet, and she saw in his hand a knife she had been seeing all her life. Her eyes seized upon it, and her mind tried to remember where she had seen it last. Whose was it, her father's or her brother's? He came to her and touched her shoulder as if waking her, and they looked at each other. Helen, so terrified by now that she was no longer afraid, but only curious with the mute, marble-like curiosity of a child, and her father stern and silent, until a rush of hatred transformed his face into a mass of wrinkles, the skin mottled red and white. He did not raise the knife, but slammed it into her chest up to the hilt so that his whitened fist struck her body, and her blood exploded out upon it. Afterward, he washed the knife in the dirty water and put it away. He squatted and looked out over the river, then his thighs began to ache and he sat on the ground, a few feet from her body. He sat there for hours as if waiting for some idea to come to him. Then the water began to darken very slowly, and the sky darkened a little while later, as if belonging to another separate time, the same thing as always, and he had to turn his mind with an effort to the next thing he must do. And that story was By the River by Joyce Carol Oates, from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Laurie Moore.
You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. Love and Bread by Jan August Strindberg.
When young Gustav Falk, the assistant counselor, made his ceremonial proposal for Louise's hand to her father, the old gentleman's first question was, "How much are you earning?" "Not more than 100 kroner a month, but Louise..." "Never mind the rest," interrupted Falk's prospective father-in-law. "You don't earn enough." "Oh, but Louise and I love each other so dearly. We are so sure of one another." "Very likely. However, let me ask you, is 1,200 a year the sum total of your resources?" "We first became acquainted at Lindingo." "Do you make anything beside your government salary?" persisted Louise's parent. "Well, yes, I think we shall have sufficient, and then you see our mutual affection." "Yes, exactly. But let's have a few figures." "Oh," said the enthusiastic suitor, "I can get you enough by doing extra work." "What sort of work, and how much?" "I can give lessons in French and also translate, and then I can get some proofreading." "How much translation?" queried the elder, pencil in hand. "I can't say exactly, but at present I'm translating a French book at the rate of 10 kroner per folio." "How many folios are there altogether?" "About a couple of dozen, I should say." "Very well. Put this at 250 kroner. Now, how much else?" "Oh, I don't know. It's a little uncertain." "What, you are not certain, and you intend to marry? You seem to have queer notions of marriage, young man. Do you realize that there will be children, and that you will have to feed and clothe them and bring them up?" "But," objected Falk, "the children may not come so very soon, and we love each other so dearly that..." "That the arrival of children may be prophesied quite safely." Then, relenting, Louise's father went on. "I suppose you are both set on marrying, and I don't doubt but what you are really fond of each other. So it seems as though I should have to give my consent after all. Only make good use of the time that you are engaged, Louise, by trying to increase your income." Young Falk flushed with joy at this sanction and demonstratively kissed the old man's hand. Heavens, how happy he was! And his Louise, too! How proud they felt the first time they went out walking together arm in arm, and how everybody noticed the radiant happiness of the engaged couple. In the evenings he came to see her, bringing with him the proof sheets he had undertaken to correct. This made a good impression on Papa and earned the industrious young man a kiss from his betrothed. But one evening they went to the theater for a change and drove home in a cab, the cost of that evening's entertainment amounting to 10 kroner. Then, on a few other evenings, instead of giving the lessons, he called at the lady's house to take her for a little walk. As the day set for the wedding drew near, they had to think about making the necessary purchases to furnish their flat. They bought 2 handsome beds of real walnut, with substantial spring mattresses and soft eiderdown quilts. Louise must have a blue quilt, as her hair was blonde. They, of course, also paid a visit to the house furnishers, where they selected a lamp with a red shade, pretty porcelain statuette of Venus, a complete table service with knives, forks, and fine glassware. In picking out the kitchen utensils, they were benefited by Mama's advice and aid. It was a busy time for the assistant counselor, rushing about to find a house, looking after the workmen, seeing that all the furniture was got together, writing out checks and what not. Meanwhile, it was perfectly natural that Gustav could earn nothing extra, but when they were once married, he would easily make it up. They intended to be most economical, only a couple of rooms to start with. Anyhow, you could furnish a small apartment better than a large one. So they took a first-floor apartment at 600 kroner, consisting of 2 rooms, kitchen, and larder. At first, Louise said she would prefer 3 rooms on the top landing. But what did it matter, after all, so long as they sincerely loved each other? At last the rooms were furnished. The sleeping chamber was like a small sanctuary, the beds standing side by side like chariots taking their course along life's journey. The blue quilts, the snowy sheets, and the pillow spreads embroidered with the young people's initials amorously intertwined, all had bright and cheerful appearance. There was a tall, elegant screen for the use of Louise, whose piano, costing 1,200 kroner, stood in the other chamber, which served as a sitting room, dining room, and study in one. Here, too, stood a large walnut writing desk and dining table with chairs to match, a large gilt frame mirror, a sofa, and a bookcase added to the general air of comfort and coziness. The marriage ceremony took place on a Saturday night, and late on Sunday morning the happy young couple was still asleep. Gustav rose first. Although the bright light of day was peering in through the shutters, he did not open them, but lit the red-shaded lamp, which threw a mysterious rosy glow over the porcelain Venus. The pretty young wife lay there languid and content. She had slept well and had not been awakened, as it was Sunday, by the rumbling of early market wagons. Now the church bells were ringing joyfully as if to celebrate the creation of man and woman. Louise turned over while Gustav retired behind the screen to put on a few things. He went out into the kitchen to order lunch. How dazzlingly the new copper and tin utensils gleamed and glistened, and all was his own, his and hers. He told the cook to go to the neighboring restaurant and request that the lunch be sent in. The proprietor knew about it. He had received full instructions the day before. All he needed now was a reminder that the moment had come. The bridegroom thereupon returns to the bedchamber and taps softly. "May I come in?" A little scream is heard. Then, "No, dearest, just wait a minute." Gustav lays the table himself. By the time the lunch arrives from the restaurant, the new plates and cutlery and glasses are set out on the fresh white linen cloth. The bridal bouquet lies beside Louise's place. As she enters the room in her embroidered morning wrapper, she is greeted by the sunbeams. She still feels a little tired, so he makes her take an armchair and wheels it to the table. A drop or two of liqueur enlivens her. A mouthful of caviar stimulates her appetite. Fancy what Mama would say if she saw her daughter drinking spirits. But that's the advantage of being married, you know. Then you could do whatever you please. The young husband waits most attentively upon his fair bride. What a pleasure, too. Of course he has had good luncheons before in his bachelor days, but what comfort or satisfaction had he ever derived from them? None. Thus he reflects while consuming a plate of oysters and a glass of beer. What numbskulls they are, those bachelors not to marry, and how selfish! Why, there ought to be a tax on them as on dogs. Louise is not quite so severe, urging gently and sweetly that perhaps the poor fellows who elect the single state are subjects of pity. No doubt, if they could afford to marry, they would, she thinks. Gustav feels a slight pang at his heart. Surely happiness is not to be measured by money. No, no, but, well, never mind. There will soon be lots of work, and then everything will run smoothly. For the present, there is this delicious roast partridge with cranberry sauce to be considered, and the burgundy. These luxuries, together with some fine artichokes, cause the young wife a moment's alarm, and she timidly asks Gustav if they can afford living on such a scale. But Gustav pours more wine into the glass of his little Louise, reassuring her and softening those groundless fears. One day is not every day, he says, and people ought to enjoy life when they can. Ah, how beautiful life is! At 6 o'clock, an elegant carriage, with two horses, pulls up before the door, and the bridal pair take a drive. Louise is charmed as they roll along through the park, reclining there so comfortably while they meet acquaintances on foot, who bow to them in obvious astonishment and envy. The assistant counselor has made a good match, they must think. He has chosen a girl with money, and they, poor souls, have to walk. How much pleasanter to ride without effort, leaning against these soft cushions. It is symbolical of agreeable married life. The first month was one of unceasing enjoyment, balls, parties, dinners, suppers, theaters. Still, the time they spent at home was really the best of all. It was a delightful sensation to carry Louise off home from her parents at night when they could do as they pleased under their own roof. Arriving at the flat, they would make a little supper and then they would sit comfortably chatting until a late hour. Gustav was all for economy, the theory of it, that is to say. One day the young bride and housekeeper tried smoked salmon with boiled potatoes. How she relished it, too! But Gustav demurred, and when smoked salmon day came round again, he invested in a brace of partridges. These he bought at the market for a kroner, exulting over the splendid bargain of which Louise did not approve. She had once bought a pair for less money. Besides, to eat game was extravagant. However, it would not do to disagree with her husband about such a trifling matter. After a couple of months more, Louise Falk became strangely indisposed. Had she caught cold, or had she perchance been poisoned by the metal kitchen utensils? The doctor who was called in merely laughed and said it was all right. A queer diagnosis, to be sure, when the young lady was seriously ailing. Perhaps there was arsenic in the wallpaper. Falk took some to a chemist, binding him to make a careful analysis. The chemist's report stated the wallpaper to be quite free from any harmful substance. His wife's sickness not abating, Gustav began to investigate on his own account, his studies in a medical book resulting in a certainty as to her ailment. She took warm foot baths, and in a month's time her state was declared entirely promising. This was sudden, sooner than they had expected, yet how lovely to be Papa and Mama. Of course, the child would be a boy, no doubt of that, and one must think of a name to give him. Meanwhile, though, Louise took her husband aside and reminded him that since their marriage he had earned nothing to supplement his salary, which had proved far from sufficient. Well, it was true they had lived rather high, but now a change should be made and everything would be satisfactory. Next day the assistant counselor went to see his good friend, the barrister, with a request that he endorse a promissory note. This would allow him to borrow the money that would be needed to meet certain unavoidable forthcoming expenses, as Falk made clear to his friend. "Yes," agreed the man of law, "marrying and raising a family is an expensive business. I have never been able to afford it." Falk felt too much ashamed to press his request, and when he returned home empty-handed was greeted with the news that two strangers had been in the house and had asked for him. They must be lieutenants in the army, thought Gustav, friends belonging to the garrison of Fort Vaxholm. No, he was told, they could not have been lieutenants. They were much older-looking men. Ah, then they were two fellows he used to know in Uppsala. They had probably heard of his marriage and had come to look him up. Only the servant said they were not from Uppsala, but were Stockholmers and carried sticks. Mysterious, very, but no doubt they would come back. Then the young husband went marketing again. He bought strawberries, at a bargain, of course. "Just fancy," he triumphantly exclaimed to his housewife, "a pint of these large strawberries for a kroner and a half at this time of year." "Oh, but Gustav, dear, we can't afford that sort of thing." "Never mind, darling, I've arranged for some extra work. But what about our debts?" "Debts? Why, I'm going to make a big loan and pay them all off at once that way." "Ah," objected Louise, "but won't this simply mean a new debt?" "No matter if it does. It will be a respite, you know. But why discuss such unpleasant things? What capital strawberries, eh, dear? And don't you think a glass of sherry would go well now after the strawberries?" Upon which the servant was sent out for a bottle of sherry, the best, naturally. When Falk's wife awoke from her afternoon nap on the sofa that day, she apologetically reverted to the subject of debt. She hoped he would not be angry at what she had to say. Angry? No, of course not. What was it? Did she want some money for the house? Louise explained. The grocer has not been paid, the butcher has threatened us, and the livery stable man also insists on having his bills settled. Is that all? Replied the assistant counselor. They shall be paid at once, tomorrow, every farthing. But let's think of something else. How would you like to go out for a little drive to the park? You'd rather not take a carriage? All right, then, there's a tramway. That will take us to the park. So they went to the park, and they had dinner in a private room at the Alhambra restaurant. It was great fun, too, because people in the general dining room thought they were a frisky young pair of lovers. This idea amused Gustav, although Louise seemed a trifle depressed, especially when she saw the bill. They could have had a good deal at home for that amount. The months go by, and now arises the need for actual preparation, a cradle, infant's clothing, and so forth. Falk has no easy time raising the money. The livery stable man and the grocer refuse further credit, for they too have families to feed. What shocking materialism! At length the eventful day arrives. Gustav must secure a nurse, and even while holding his newborn daughter in his arms, is called out to pacify his creditors. The fresh responsibilities weigh heavily upon him. He almost breaks down under the strain. He succeeds, it is true, in getting some translation to do, but how can he perform the work when at every touch and turn he's obliged to run errands? In this frame of mind he appeals to his father-in-law for help. The old gentleman receives him coldly. "I will help you this once, but not again. I have little enough myself, and you are not my only child. Delicacies must be provided for the mother, chicken and expensive wine, and the nurse has to be paid." Fortunately, Falk's wife is soon on her feet again. She's like a girl once more, with a slender figure. Her pallor is quite becoming. Louise's father talks seriously to his son-in-law, however. "Now, no more children, if you please, unless you want to be ruined." For a brief space, the Junior Falk family continued to live on love and increasing debts. But one day bankruptcy knocked at the door. The seizure of the household effects was threatened. Then the old man came and took away Louise and her child, and as they rode off in a cab he made the bitter reflection that he had lent his girl to a young man who had given her back after a year, dishonored. Louise would willingly have stayed with Gustav, but there was nothing more to subsist on. He remained behind, looking on while the bailiffs, those men with the sticks, denuded the flat of everything, furniture, bedding, crockery, cutlery, kitchen utensils, until it was stripped bare. Now began real life for Gustav. He managed to get a position as proofreader on a newspaper which was published in the morning, so that he had to work at his desk for several hours each night. As he had not actually been declared a bankrupt, he was allowed to keep his place in the government service, although he could hope for no more promotion. His father-in-law made the concession of letting him see his wife and child on Sundays, but he was never permitted to be alone with them. When he left in the evening to go to the newspaper office, they would accompany him to the gate, and he would depart in utter humiliation of soul. It might take him perhaps 20 years to pay off all his obligations. And then? Yes, what then? Could he then support his wife and child? No, probably not. If in the meantime his father-in-law should die, they would be left without a home. So he must be thankful even to the hard-hearted old man who had so cruelly separated them. Ah, yes, human life itself is indeed hard and cruel. The beasts of the field find maintenance easily enough, while of all created beings man alone must toil and spin. It is a shame, yes, it is a crying shame, that in this life everybody is not provided with gratuitous partridges and strawberries. And that story was Love and Bread by Juan August Strindberg from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.